Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2008 Home Education Conference held in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
My name is Julie Early, and the topic for this hour is Introduction to Thomas Jefferson Education, Part 1, The Four Phases of Education. In 1977, Spencer W. Kimball proclaimed, "Oh, how our world needs statesmen." And we ask, why not? We have the raw material. We have the spiritual climate. We must train statesmen, not demagogues. Men of integrity, not weaklings who for a mess of pottage will sell their birthright. We must develop these precious youth to know the art of statesmanship, to know people and conditions, to know situations and problems, but men who will be so trained, who'll be trained so thoroughly in the arts of their future work and in the basic honesties and integrities and spiritual concepts that there will be no compromise of principle. That's quite a tall order. Is it possible to create such leaders? Absolutely. And just as President Kimball said, as LDS, we have the raw material and we have the spiritual climate. But to create such kinds of leaders, we need to do it in a specific way. In the history of the world, we seem to find three different types of education. Nations were made, flourished, and were destroyed by the use or disuse of these three types of education. The founders of our nation knew that to grow and prosper, we needed all three to remain intact. Unfortunately, as has been the trend for millennia, the one type of education seems to expand and squash one and sometimes both of the other types. If we are to discuss leadership education or Thomas Jefferson education in any type of depth, we must have a thorough understanding of the three types of education to ensure we don't stray and make leadership education something it is not, which happens quite easily because all of us are usually trained in one specific type of education. And it takes quite a bit to make the leap to something very, very different. And often we need to be reminded time and time again exactly what it is that we're shooting for. So I'm going to go over the three different types. And I'm not going to go over in extreme depth because I want to get in on some other things. If you want more depth, tomorrow I'll speak in great depth on the three different types. But in brief, the three types are employee education, professional education, and leadership education. In order for a country to be a country, to actually make it into the history books, they need to have at least two types, and that is leadership education and professional education. You have to have leaders in a nation, and you have to have some kind of professional class that can make the country grow and prosper. If you want to really step it up and move that country to a greater place, a prosperous place, you add the third type. And that third type, employee education, otherwise known sometimes as conveyor belt education, is what educates the masses so that the whole country can rise together in a very prosperous way. Each type of education has its goals, its methods, and its curriculum, as well as a life path that's connected to it. And like I said, we'll go over these really briefly. In employee education, the goal is to train workers, to train employees, to basically train people to enter the workforce. In professional education, you're training experts, whether they're doctors or dentists, accountants, mechanics, or in older times, coopers and farriers and blacksmiths. Leadership education has two goals: to train leaders, statesmen, as well as to teach them what freedom is and what it takes to maintain it. The methods to teach these goals are very different. The first, employee education, has what we call a Soviet conveyor belt method. This isn't a derogatory term, it's a very descriptive term. So we'll start with the conveyor belt element first. We all know what a conveyor belt is, hopefully. Something in a factory where people have different stations and they do different things for a particular product to make it what it needs to be by the end in order to sell it. In a conveyor belt type of education, classes are divided and children are put into those classes based on a certain criteria. We do it based on age. And they are given specific things at each stop. And everybody is given the same things, regardless of where they're from or what their likes and dislikes are. They all receive the same thing. They're all tested the same. They all receive the same books. They're all graded the same on a preset criteria. So they go through first grade, second grade, third grade, and on and up through the conveyor belt till it's 11th grade, 12th grade, a diploma stamped on their forehead, and they're sent into the job market. That's the conveyor belt element of employee education. Now let's talk about the Soviet element. When we talk about a Soviet conveyor belt, it means that we want to make sure that everybody makes it through the conveyor belt system. So they usually gear the education of each grade based on the lowest 5th to 15th percentile to make sure that everybody makes it through the conveyor belt. It's kind of like this concept, and maybe you remember this if you went to a conveyor belt type school, where you're constantly kind of keeping with your peers. And if somebody gets ahead, very few people are going to step up and go, oh, yeah, let's keep you going ahead and ahead and ahead. They usually just kind of leave you alone until you fall back in line. Now, if you fall behind, that's a huge tragedy because the whole system was made so everybody stays together. And so they give you extra help, whether it's remedial courses or special education things, to keep you with your group. And you're always together as you go through the grades. So that's the Soviet conveyor belt model. The division is by age, and they keep you in the model by compulsion or force. The professional education model also has a conveyor belt, but it's a very different type of conveyor belt. It's a competitive conveyor belt. And I think all of us can see where the conveyor belt would actually work in this system very well. We would like to make sure that our experts receive certain things at certain times. You don't want to know that your dentist decided to go to some creative school where they didn't teach drilling, you know. Like, everybody can drill, it's just push the button, right? So it's pretty easy. Get on to more creative things in this dental school. That's a little frightening. You want to make sure that your dentist went through all the classes he's supposed to take, right? As well as your accountant and your doctor and your attorney. You want to make sure they went through all the things, all the little stations, to make sure they have everything they need to be the expert that you've chosen them to be. Like I said, this conveyor belt is different. It's a competitive conveyor belt, which means that it's not geared to the 5th or 15th percentile. It's geared to like the 85th, 95th percentile, so that only the best make it into whether it's Harvard Law or even just a really great medical school. So if you don't do very well your first year, you wash out. You're not going to be a doctor. You need to keep your grades up. It's hard to get into those kinds of schools. You have to have a certain kind of GPA going through your bachelor's program. So it's very, very competitive. The division is by aptitude and ability, and you're kept where you are by the threat of failure. Now let's talk about the methods used in leadership education. It's not a conveyor belt at all. Basically, it's mentoring. The division is by phases of learning, and you're kept where you are or go through the system based on modeling and inspiration. Let me explain what mentoring is. Mentoring is basically when someone sits down with a student and says, so what are you interested in? What are your goals? What do you think your life mission is? What are your talents? What are the things you really, really enjoy? What are the things that scare you a little bit? Where are the holes in your education? And then they design a curriculum based on that individual. In leadership education, the methodology is very individualized. It depends on the mission, talents, likes, abilities of that particular student, and it's not going to be the same, even in a family, between children. It'll be different. And like I said, the division is through phases of learning, which we'll talk about more in depth in a moment. Now let's talk about the curriculum of these three types. In employee education, the curriculum is textbooks. Now, I say that, but really the number one curriculum, the biggest thing, is socialization. See, if you really want to create a great workforce, you have to make sure that these people feel comfortable in their environment. If they don't feel comfortable in a work environment, they're not going to want to stay. So if the goal is to create people who want to get jobs, they need to feel comfortable in those jobs, and so you socialize them to feel comfortable there. So you create an environment that's a little bit like a factory or an executive environment where there's, and it's interesting because our schools used to be more factory model, and now they're a bit more open, more like an executive model where you have breezeways in between classrooms, and there's a certain hierarchy. You're here, there's kids below you, there's kids above you, you're judged by your peers as well as a group that's above this, your teachers, and you know that you can kind of move up in the system. I mean, some people have made the comparison, like your first grade, that's like the mail room, second grade, secretarial pool, until you're like fifth or sixth grade, and you're like the executive, get the key to the bathrooms, the whole thing. You know, that's, and then you all of a sudden have to drop back down in junior high. You can draw the comparisons a lot of different ways. But there's bells that ring, you go to your lockers and you change things, and it's very much like a work environment. They're also taught, like I said, through textbooks. Textbooks are very specific in the way that they're designed. C.S. Lewis talked about this. He did a study on textbooks specifically. He had begun his study on wondering if you can read a particular book and know exactly what the author wanted you to know, what their motives were based on their work. And he decided to move his study to textbooks and kind of see if you could do the same thing with a textbook. And he found that you could. And he wrote his analysis, part of his analysis, in something called The Abolition of Man, and a specific essay called Men Without Chests. He said in Men Without Chests that textbooks were designed to create men and women who didn't stand for anything. They were men without chests. These people could very compliantly do repetitive tasks and not really be upset about things if somebody wanted to change something. So somebody comes down and says, this is the new policy, we're doing this instead. And they say, oh, okay, sounds good. Instead of, what do you mean? That's stupid. That wouldn't even make sense. That wouldn't work in a work environment. So he says textbooks were created to make people not passionate anymore, to make them just kind of take information in a very non-passionate way. Oh, there's this war, and it happened, and these people died, and it's, you know, off to other things. They're also taught, the same thing is done in schools, when you change classes very quickly. You're an hour here, you're an hour there. You're never really interested in anything because you're not there for very long. They're also taught through this curriculum what to think. The textbooks do this. They tell you, here's what happened, and here's what you think about what happens. And you're tested on what to think about that thing. In the professional model, their curriculum is different than a textbook. It's case studies. And they're taught through case studies when to think, which means that if they're an attorney, they're going to go through a lot of different cases on maybe a specific type of law or a specific thing in the law, maybe in the constitution of a state or whatever it is. And they're going to learn what happened through precedent when things were, you know, ruled on. And that's, you know, in that particular area. And they learn that they can be creative for a client in their area. So they can say, well, I have this client, he has this particular problem, I can go back through and find these particular cases, and I think I can prove that he can win through this kind of method of precedent. So he's very creative in his field. But when it comes to, like, let's say, accounting, an attorney knows you turn to another expert. You don't do it yourself. You go to someone else who's been trained in that thing. So they're very creative in their field. They know when to think. They think within their expertise. And then they go to other experts in other fields for other things. And I think we appreciate that. I don't think we want to go to our mechanic and have him tell us a bunch of things about how we can fix our health. And, you know, you're thinking, man, just fix the car. Go to someone else about the health, you know. So we kind of expect our experts to stay within their fields. They're also socialized. They're socialized for expertise. And this is done basically through internships and things that are done kind of outside the classroom. And another way of saying socialized for expertise is basically learning how to understand ethics. They're taught through internships and other experiences outside the classroom what is acceptable in their field and what isn't acceptable, what is rejected as unethical and what is accepted as ethical. This is what we think is okay. This is what we think is not okay. It's a certain type of socialization. They're also taught how to mix and mingle with their peers and when to give the expertise to someone else because they're not as well trained in that particular area of the field. In leadership education, the curriculum is classics. Now let me just explain quickly. When I use the word classic, I'm not talking about things from the Greco-Roman period. I'm not talking about a specific list that some professor came up with, the classics of the American tradition, or whatever it is. I'm talking about something, whether it's a book or a piece of art or music or whatever it is, something that you can study over and over and over again and get something new every time you study it. That's the definition of classic I'm using, which means that there's a lot of different things that can be classic, and it may be very particular to you what is classic. Hopefully all of you have had some kind of an experience with something that is classic. I'm hoping that since we're a group of LDS people that we have had an experience with the Book of Mormon. We read it over and over and over again, right? They ask us to read it over and over and over again for obviously a particular reason. And I think all of us have been able to have that experience where reading through and go, wow, has that been there this whole time? I had no idea. And it just hits us, this scripture, in a way you may have even already marked it and had something off to the side, but now it really hits you in a new way. It's classic. You get something new every time you go to it. So the curriculum of leadership education is classics. And they are taught through classics how to think. The great thing about reading classics, especially with a mentor and not a textbook, is that you're not told what to think about Plato. And you're not reading what someone thought about what someone thought about what someone thought about Plato said. You're reading Plato, and you're making the decision for yourself. And you're grappling with the Republic going, I don't know how I feel about this. Everybody says that this is a great book, but I don't know. It's like communism. It really bothers me. And you read it over and over again. I know I've read the Republic about six times. It wasn't until the sixth time that I actually got it. And I liked it. And I thought it was awesome. But it took that many times to get through it and learn the different layers. It teaches us how to think. There's also socialization as part of the curriculum in leadership education. It's not going to be the same percentage. In employee education, it's usually about 80% socialization, 20% textbooks. And if you think that's really, really high, pull your kids out of school and see if anybody asks you, but what about their academics? They're going to ask you, but what about their social life? Because it really is the most important thing, right? And obviously, it's not going to be as high in professional education. In leadership education, you're looking at probably, depending on the phase of learning, somewhere between 80% in classics and 20% in socialization, or even less than that, 90-10. And when we're talking about socialization for leadership, that's a specific type of socialization. And let me just tell you, often, I know, because I was homeschooled, the word socialization becomes kind of a dirty word for some reason. It's like, we don't do that. We don't do socialization. Well, guess what? You're going to be socialized if you are with people. You're going to be social. So get used to the fact that socialization happens regardless of whether you plan on it or not. It's best to plan on it or it just becomes default. Whatever type of socialization you have, that's what everybody in your family is going to have. So if you want to have a certain kind of socialization going on in your family, you need to plan it. You need to actually be proactive about how you go about socializing your children. Socializing for leadership means that people feel comfortable leading and in positions where they are not maybe the leader, but in a leadership role as they help one another in a group. So they feel comfortable with people who are very old and very young and everybody in between. And it's not that they feel, I mean, I've seen this happen quite often with some homeschools kids where they lose all respect for age levels and they talk to an adult just like they would talk to a six-year-old. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying they know how to where respect is and how to show respect to people, but they're very comfortable in a lot of different settings, whether they're at a formal dinner or whether they're helping at some homeless shelter. They learn to feel comfortable in very different situations because leaders will never know what kind of situations they're going to be called in to help with. But the more we can put them in different situations so they feel comfortable in new and very different things from their own family culture, the more they'll be comfortable in leadership positions and in leadership experiences. Now, let me just tell you that homeschooling does not equal leadership education. The three types have very little to do with location and have everything to do with what happens in that location. I can show you classrooms in a public school system where leadership education is happening because there's a teacher there who's off the conveyor belt. And I can show you homeschools, because ours was one of them, where conveyor belt education is happening. It's all about the conveyor belt. It's all about getting a job at the end. So location has very little to do with it. It has everything to do with the goals, the methods, the curriculum that I just talked about. I forgot to mention the life path. I apologize for that. In employee education, the life path is to get a job. and keep it. In professional education, it's to have a career or profession and then retire. Excuse me. Those are very much linked together, career and retirement. And then in leadership education, the concept is ownership and then statesmanship. And I'm going to quickly explain, when I say ownership, it doesn't mean you have to own your own business, although that happens quite often with statesmen. It means that you need to have an ownership outlook, which means that regardless of whether you work for someone else or you work for yourself, you own what you do. It's your responsibility. If you fail, you know that it's not just, oh, well, I failed my job. It's a bigger deal than that. It's, you know, you've done something to keep, you know, to make someone go bankrupt, whether it's you or somebody else. It means that you're an intrapreneur. If you may not be an entrepreneur, you're someone who owns your job. It's important to you. You are an intrapreneur within your job. When I worked for George with College, I obviously was not self-employed. I worked for someone else, but I owned my job as the dean of off-campus studies. It was just as if it was my business. And then statesmanship, which is not necessarily retirement, where there's a lot of leisure time, but it's impact, societal impact, changing your community and the world for the better. Now, for some of you who may have learned about these different types of education and started leadership education, let me just tell you that you need to go back through these goals and methods and curriculum often, because you'll find yourself back on the conveyor belt without even noticing. These things creep up on us. It's this little, we were trained in it. It's good. I mean, man, you're trained on the conveyor belt. It stays with you for a very long time. It's ingrained in you. So it takes a while to get off the conveyor belt. So you'll need to review over and over and over again. Am I requiring my children too much? Because requiring, the idea of forcing, compulsion, that's part of the conveyor belt model. That's not leadership. Leadership is inspiration. It's modeling, which we'll talk about in a second. It's not about comparing either. That's the conveyor belt, when you're constantly going, am I up with everybody else? Am I doing everything everybody else is doing? Oh, because I'm okay. That's the conveyor belt model. So if you're worrying about your kids, oh, our neighbor's reading more than you're reading, oh my goodness, you know, that kind of thing, that's employee education. Now, like I said, modeling is one of the most important things in employee education. Mentoring, modeling, inspiration. So everything I say from now on applies to you first and then your children. So every time you write something down like, oh, I need to do this for my kids, stop. Say, I need to do this for me. Because this is about you showing your children how to do it, so they can look at you and model exactly what you're doing and then they can be inspired by you. That's how leadership education works. We're going to talk about 6 phases of learning. And I'm going to put them up here just so we are aware of what they are. The first is core phase. The next is love of learning. And then scholar phase. Depth. Whoops. Mission. And impact. And we can divide these up into sections, this first being fundamental phases, the next being kind of academic phases, and then the third being application phases. We can make this, when I say academic, it could be educational phases, whatever is easiest for you to kind of get your mind around. Okay, so we're going to start with core and love of learning, the fundamental phases. And I'm going to put some ages in connection with this. And I really cringe at doing this, because most of the time when we're talking in conveyor belt ease, when we hear ages, we divide kids up very specifically into certain ages. So I'm going to give you some ages, and it's within a margin of error of 90 years, okay? So just, these are ballpark, so ballpark. But at least it'll give you some type of an idea. Core phase is going to be roughly 0 to 8. And like I said, it could be 0 to 52. But it's basically, we're going to talk about it being 0 to 8. And let me just tell you, the reason that these are called foundational phases is because they are foundational. And any type of temptation you have to kind of jump over these to get to the important academic phases, it's going to basically kill the whole program. So these are the most important phases. If you leave without even remembering what scholar phase is about, but just remember exactly what core phase is, you're good. So these truly are fundamental and will affect all of the other phases from this point forward. And these aren't linear either. These phases are more like, it's not like, well, I'm in core phase, and then I get into love of learning, and then I'm into scholar phase. It's more like I'm in core phase, and I'm going to add love of learning, add scholar phase, add depth, but I always have a core. I'm always working on firming up my core. Do the phases happen in order? Absolutely. They have to happen in order as far as when we add a new phase on. This, the curriculum for this particular phase, the things that you need to learn, is right, wrong, good, bad, true, false. You need to be able to tell the difference between right and wrong, good and bad, true and false. In this phase, we're learning to find an authority. Hopefully that authority is God, and you're creating a relationship with God. You're learning how to acquaint yourself with the scriptures, to know how to find answers there, to know how to receive promptings from the Spirit. And you're creating a spectrum of truth. This spectrum is something you're going to use throughout your education, and it's in core phase that we create it. We use our authority. Like I said, when I speak to other groups that are not LDS, then I have to be, you know, I have to give them a lot of options for their authority. But it's nice. I can say, your authority is God, and you're going to use the scriptures because that's where he's given us answers. So build a relationship with God and learn how to find answers in the scriptures. And as you do, you begin to plot things on your spectrum. And basically, you're plotting them on the ends. This is good. This is bad. This is true. This is false. So they learn about lying, and they learn that it's bad. They learn about tithing, and they learn that it's good. They learn about smoking or drinking, they learn that it's bad. They learn about charity and service, they learn that that's good. So they're putting things on their spectrum. Throughout their education, they'll begin to put things in the middle. But right now, we're just working on the ends. And developmentally, it works very well with children. I mean, you know your kids are going to ask you, is he the bad guy or the good guy? You know, they're always going to ask you those kinds of very extreme questions. They're not going to ask you about little nuances. It's usually the ends of the spectrum. They learn also through this phase to work and to play. And they do a lot of playing, which is good because that's where they learn about relationships. That's the other key of core phase. They learn about relationships. What happens when they hit their sister? There's a consequence. It's not just my mom's mad at me. My sister's mad at me too. And there may be some problems now because there was some hitting or stealing or whatever went on in a relationship. They realize that just saying sorry isn't always going to cut it. Sometimes there's hurt feelings that take time to heal. So core phase is about relationships, learning how to be with one another, to play with one another, to work with one another. And they learn the same things in work, but it's mostly in play, which means it's not you guys go play and you guys go work. It's a lot. We should go play and we should go work because then you can mentor them through relationship issues. If you're not in the room, it's going to be very difficult for you to help them step back and say, okay, I know that they just pulled your hair, but what can we do instead of pulling their hair back? You know, and ask them questions and help them work through it. I have a friend of mine whose kids are very used to having what they call DAs or do it again. So they'll walk into a room and something will have gone on and tempers flare on and on. All of a sudden someone will say, DA, DA, DA. And they walk out and they come back in and decide they're going to handle the situation differently. So in their family, they have kind of a second chance to get through a relationship issue when tempers are a little bit hot. They also learn through work about order. They learn that they need to keep their rooms clean. They need to have a certain order in their life. And we know as adults that God's house is a house of order. That in order for us to learn, we need to have an ordered mind. And we do that through keeping things around us in order. Children learn this at a very young age during in core phase, that they need to have things in order, whether it's pulling the weeds out of a garden or the way that we clean the bathroom or the way that we fold laundry, whatever it is, they learn there's a specific order and a prioritization that goes on in working. So they work and they play. They learn about their authority and they learn about relationships and order. Now, I'm sure some of you are thinking, so where's the reading and the math and, you know, all the important things that should go on? Yeah, they'll come, but they're not in core phase. Core phase is about relationships and order, working and playing, and learning right from wrong, good from bad, true from false. And before you start freaking out thinking, oh my gosh, my kid will be 8 and he won't know how to read, calm down. Just know this. A, this is not brand new. Dr. DeMille didn't write this book because he thought some new thing up. Oh, this will be fun. We'll try this leadership education thing. No, this has actually been the model that has been used for centuries. Remember, I told you there are 3 different types of education. And the types have been here for a very long time. But what sometimes happens is that one type of education, employee education, squashes out in leadership education because it's a whole heck of a lot harder. And sometimes even professional education. And everybody gets caught in the conveyor belt. And no one's being leaders. And that's when countries die, because no one's stepping up. So when you want to go find out what leadership education is like, instead of reading Dr. DeMille, you can just go read a bunch of different biographies of leaders. And you'll find that they went through a leadership education, which started with a core phase that was very, very specific. Now, am I saying that your child will not read until they're 8? No. Remember, I told you this was give or take 90 years. So you may have a child who on their own says, Mommy, 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 I want to read. It's going to be so fun. That's called play. When they come to you and say, Mommy, Mommy, show me what this word is. Or Daddy, Daddy, what does this mean when it's 2 + 2? For them, it's play. It's all fun. It's not like, okay, sit down. And we're gonna get your books out and get your worksheets going. It's not that. This is about, in their mind, this is about playing. And as you need to understand this as well, our children are not mini adults. They don't learn like you. Their brain isn't fully developed. In fact, they've found that children can't even have the concept of abstract thought until they're 8 on an average. So trying to teach them an abstract concept like mathematics might be very difficult for children. I've done a lot of study on this. In fact, I've been amazed how many adults have talked to me later about the games they created as children to try and understand math, because they couldn't get it, because it was too abstract for them. I mean, some of these games were extremely elaborate. The problem with that is when they get into harder math, all of a sudden, the games don't work. And they say, I hate math, because they don't understand it anymore, because it wasn't the way they created it as children. And that's because we started way too young. They weren't ready for that type of thinking. So, you're going to have a child who is going to be playing with Legos and dolls and all these kinds of things and working in your family, and they're probably going to be around a mom and a dad who are reading and who are doing math and who are learning things about science, and they're not going to go, well, I'm not going to even look at my mother. They're going to go, wow, what are you doing? And they're going to be part of it, and so they're going to pick things up, and you'll find that children will be inspired when they're ready to do certain things. When they're ready to learn math, they're going to be inspired to want to learn math. And you may have a kid at 4 years old who's all about math. It doesn't mean, oh, no, you can't study that till you're 8. No, I'm not saying that at all. When they want to study something, let them study it. But don't think this is like, now we're in, and now we're going to study math constantly. It's they're going to study until they don't get it anymore, and then they're going to stop, and they're going to go on to something else. So core phase is about love. It's about family, it's about home, it's about work, and really, when it comes down to it, and you're all worried about, you know, oh, we got to get them learning at a certain thing, isn't it nice to know that if you can do this part right, when they're 30, they're not going to be calling Dr. Laura? You know what I mean? Because they're going to know what's right and what's wrong, because you did this phase right. You took the time to make sure they knew how to talk to God. You took time to make sure that they could talk to family members and work through problems. Because when they're adults and they're having to work through relationship issues, it's expensive. And the consequences are much heavier. And when they're having to play later because they didn't play when they were younger, it's a lot more expensive. So it's okay to take, even if it's 7 or 8 years, to do this part right, because it will make a certain kind of person in the end. If we do this part right, they will naturally leap into love of learning. Now, hopefully you've all written this down, right? Love of learning. I want you to cross out this word and circle this word. So I don't want you to think, okay, now you're 8. Dr. Early said that now you learn, and now you're going to study math, and now you're going to read, now you're going to do all these things, because this is when you're going to have to hunker down now. This is about learning how to love learning. Often, we get to the point where we start thinking about 6, 7, or 8, when we start looking at our friends' children or people in our ward, and we start comparing our children to them, and we think, okay, you've got to hurry and measure up. I mean, come on, everybody else is doing, you know, times tables. You've got to get up. You've got to go, oh, my heavens, you've got to hurry. And what you're teaching your children is, we really worry about what other people think about us. We constantly compare ourselves to other people. It's really important what other people think about us. That's not what leaders need to be hearing. What you're modeling is, I was on the conveyor belt. Do you want to get on it too? In love of learning, your children will flit from thing to thing because they're learning to love learning, and they're learning how to discover. They're learning about things that they're good at. They're learning about trying new things and building confidence. So they will be all into dolphins and be like, dolphins are my thing, and all of a sudden it's swords. And you don't know where the change happened, but all of a sudden it's swords, and then it's math, and then it's some other thing, and all of a sudden they're just in and out of all these different things. And they may be totally into math, and then they're totally not. They might be totally into reading, and then they're not. So you really can't say, and this happens all the time, you'll see your son doing something, you think, oh yeah, that's what they're doing. And then you just buy all this curriculum to go with that thing. And then he's not doing it anymore. And then you do this other thing, you know. The best thing is just to create an environment of learning and let them go. And if you're doing your education and you're modeling it, they're just going to follow along. Mom is in the backyard doing science experiments. That's cool. So they go in the backyard and they start doing science experiments. And when you're not looking, they're looking at cause and effect. You know, they may say, well, Mom's doing this or Dad's doing that. And then they want to be a part of that. They want to learn. They want to be just like you. And so they start playing with learning, and they start enjoying it, and they start building a confidence in themselves that they can try new things and it's not that bad. They don't have to worry about failure. It's okay for them to stop when they don't understand. And that's usually why they do stop. They get to a point where either they've learned all that they can with their base of knowledge, or they get to something that's just too hard. They need to go learn something else until they have the skills to tackle that thing again. They'll also be into, like, the guitar. And you'll go buy the guitar, and you'll have the guitar lessons, and it'll be very expensive, and they'll be into, like, the drums. And you're thinking, but we have the guitar! You're going to have to stay in the guitar lessons, and you're going to force them to stay, and then they hate it, and there's this relationship issue. So if a child wants to get into something that's expensive, don't just say, okay, great, let's just do everything that's expensive. No, instead, you say, okay, that's going to cost a certain amount of money. How much do you want to put towards it? How much work do you want to do to get the lessons and to rent the guitar? And then you have them sign a contract that they're going to study it for a certain amount of time. And it's never over 3 months for love of learner. I didn't put the ages on this, but basically it's 8 to 12. You just don't put it past 3 months. In 3 months, reevaluate the contract and say, do you still like the guitar? Cool. You want to add a couple more months to the contract? Great, we'll do that. But don't think that, you know, okay, we're going to study the guitar now for a year and a half, because that's not usually going to happen in love of learning. They're creating in love of learning a framework that they're going to use in scholar phase. This framework is a knowledge base. Now that they've played with all these different things and they've enjoyed all these different things in scholar phase, that's when they're going to get into it. That's when they're going to go deep. That's when they're going to do things that are really, really hard. But they're building this foundation now. They're also learning what they're good at, like I said, what their talents are. And when they learn a little bit more about what their talents are, they also have this feeling of, I'm going to do something really important in this world. I've got something really important I'm going to do. That is called a sense of personal mission. Doesn't mean that they know what their mission is, but they have this sense or feeling that they're going to do something great. And that's what propels them into scholar phase and makes them want to do really hard work. Scholar phase is somewhere between the ages of 12 and 16. And by the time they're 12 or 13 or 14 or 15, depending on when you start doing leadership education, they're going to want to get into intense study. When I talk about intense study, I mean that you're going to have a 14-year-old who studies between 8 to 12 hours a day, 5 to 6 days a week, 8 to 10 to 11 months a year. I'm serious. They want it. You don't tell them to do it. They beg you to study for 12 hours a day. I'm not insane. This really happens. There are 14-year-olds that can't get enough of learning. And you know, the nice thing is when you're able to actually see it. And you may know people who have 14, 15, 16-year-olds that love reading the Federalist Papers, that can't get enough of Les Mis or reading, Plato. Because we're not worried about what your 6-year-old looks like. We're worried about what your 16-year-old looks like. So when you're back there thinking, oh, my little 7-year-old's not reading like he should be, think, no. 17, that's what we're looking at. I want a 17-year-old that loves studying science, that wants to study science all day long. I want a 17-year-old that loves to write papers, loves doing oral exams, begs me for more books to read. That's what I want. And what should they study in scholar phase? Anything they want to at the beginning. And they'll tell you exactly what they want to study at the beginning. But as they get into scholar phase, they'll desire to have a mentor, and they want that mentor to show them where all their holes are. Where are all the holes, the things that they're lacking in their education? And then they also want that mentor to say, you know what? You're scared of doing oral exams. We should do those every day. And they say, yeah, we should. Let's do it every day. These are students who may have been afraid of writing before and now want to write articles over and over again. They want to do the things that are hard because they want to be a certain kind of person. They know they have a mission. They know they have very little time to get totally prepared for that mission. The worst thing you can do as a parent is to keep your children from studying because now they're 15. Now they run all your errands for you. Now they take care of the kids. It's great to have a 15-year-old. So a lot of times parents keep their kids from studying because they want them to do the housework. They want them to take care of the kids. That needs to stop. If your child is truly in scholar phase, you need to let them be in scholar phase. It doesn't mean they never work. It just simply means that they get a stewardship. Maybe it's the yard work or laundry or whatever it is that you as parents and the student work out. They receive a stewardship, and that's their number one priority as far as work is concerned, and then their studies. And the new responsibilities that they used to have fall to younger children. Which is great, because sometimes we just keep those responsibilities to our older kids and our younger kids don't learn to work as hard. So now, it goes back down to the 7 and 8-year and 9-year-old, now to the things that the 15-year-old used to do. And as you can see, we're nearly out of time, and I didn't plan on really going into depth, mission, and impact. I just put them out there for you to see, because we're really concerned with these first three. That's usually where you're going to be. Basically, depth is depth. It's going into extreme depth. You can't go deep unless you have a broad base of education, then you're able to go deep. The broader your base of education, the deeper you're able to go. That's why scholar phase is so important. You need to build that breadth. Then you go deep, and then you have some kind of mission that you feel like you need to accomplish. Usually you build two types of organizations, some type of an organization, whether it be a business or something like that, and then the other organization is your family. And then the final phase is impact. Now, if you have just pulled your children out of school and ready to homeschool them, know that they probably all need to start back in core phase. If you're wondering where do we start, core phase is a good place to start. Most kids are in a hate of learning when they first come home, and so you kind of have to be in core phase, reading scriptures, dealing with relationships, working and playing for a little while until the students are ready to start caring about learning again. quickly, I want to just share with you that there are some myths in education. One of the myths is that you can educate someone. It's a myth. You have never educated anyone. I've never educated anyone. We have the level of education we have because we chose it. No one chose it for us. We chose it. We have the responsibility of our own education. It's interesting because there's a lot of people fighting for the responsibility of educating certain people, especially our children. The government thinks it's their responsibility. Schools think it's theirs. Sometimes parents think it's theirs. But the one person who doesn't think it's theirs is a student. They think it's somebody else's responsibility. And until they realize it's their own, they'll never choose the type of education they should have. So the best thing you can do is to help put that responsibility back where it belongs, on the student. You should teach these phases to your children. And if you do, I promise you, they'll know exactly where they are. My aunt said, I don't think I could do this. You need to come over to my house and tell my children what the phases are. So I did. And you know what? She was shocked because in about 10 seconds, they all said, I'm in love with learning. I'm in core phase. They all just knew exactly where they were. She was like, how did they do that? Because kids know where they are. They don't have the pride hang-ups of feeling like they have to be somewhere. So teach these phases to your kids. Get them excited. You're in core phase now, and then there'll come a point where you're in love of learning, and it's so much fun. You get to do what mom's doing. We just get to study all these different things. We learn about Mozart. We learn about, Plato. We learn about Socrates. We learn about, different mathematicians like Newton. And you get them excited about it, and then you say, and then there's going to come this point when you're going to be in scholar phase. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be so hard. It's just going to blow your mind, but it's going to be great. And I'll be there. We'll read books together, and we'll discuss them. It'll be so cool. But right now, you talk about where that child is. You get them excited about what's going to come. And then one day they'll come to you and say, Mom, Dad, I think I'm in scholar phase. And you'll say, no. Are you sure? It's hard. It's so hard. Are you sure? Yeah, I think I am. Okay. Why don't you try it out for 2 days? And they will. They'll try it out, and then they'll go back and forth and back and forth. It happens quite often. And you'll be surprised one day they'll just want to study for 8 to 10 hours. You'll think, where did this kid come from? And he'll start coming up with really interesting things, really deep things that they just learned because they learned how to think. It's exciting. Let me go back to what President Kimball said. Oh, how our world needs statesmen. And we ask ourselves, why not? We have the raw material. We have the spiritual climate. We must train statesmen. We do have the raw material, and we have the spiritual climate, and now you know how to do it. And just like President Kimball used to say, just do it. Thank you.
Can you post it in your President Kimball quote?
Yeah, I can. You mean the statesman quote?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's from a talk that he gave. It was adapted from a talk that he gave at BYU called Education for Eternity, but it was actually in the Ensign in 1977. It was the first presidency message called The Gospel Vision of the Arts. Any other questions? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll just give you the Ensign. It's in the Ensign, July 1977. And the title was The Gospel Vision of the Arts. It was the first presidency message. The Gospel Vision of the Arts. Yes?
My question is, I have a 9 and 11-year-old from our public school this year. So we're going to revert back over to the core. My question is I'm trying to figure out how to do the Thomas Jefferson education and still meet the state's requirements to show.
Right. Let me just tell you, when you pull your kids out and they go back to core, it's not going to be like they're going to be in core for 8 years. Usually, it doesn't take that long for them to figure out what the new thing is about and go right into love of learning. And I don't know what state. Are you from Virginia?
Maryland.
Or from Maryland? See, I don't know what the laws are specifically in Maryland. I don't think your kids will be in core phase for long enough that it's going to be like a year. You'll probably be able to get through core phase pretty quickly, especially if you're modeling love of learning and scholar. You're showing them how to do it, they'll jump right into it, and they'll be right, probably right where they need to be as far as
what's expected of them at that particular age. Once again, you're having to deal with conveyor belt requirements and a leadership model. It's hard. It's hard to try and mesh those. Because what you're doing is leadership, and what they want is an age-specific conveyor belt. This is what you're supposed to be doing at this particular age. The one good thing is their model is based on the lowest 5th to 15th percentile. Your kids will exceed that really quickly.
So, like, what if I have to, like, first of all, I have to show my kids are not math, but they're not interested in math.
Well, you know, you get very creative with, you know, but they are totally into cooking. So all of a sudden, or they're, you know, we're all about gardening, and we figured out square footage of this particular, we have this many, you know, square inches of peas, I don't know. You can do mathematics. And once again, one of the reasons, you know, we freak out, we think, oh, our kids aren't doing math. A lot of the times when our kids aren't doing math, it's because mom and dad aren't doing math. And at home where people say, my kids hate math, and I don't understand, I ask them, well, how much math are you doing? Well, none. You know, I'm a mom. Why should I have to do math? You know, so it means that you might have to get, you know, creative and get, you know, the stories of the great mathematicians out and read about Archimedes and all these different people. And then all of a sudden, you're doing things and you're getting excited about, oh, I love this. This is awesome. And all of a sudden they're doing math. So if you're worried about a particular area, that just means you're probably not modeling it, or you're modeling it a little bit too fakely. You know what I mean? You're not really interested in, you're just kind of putting on a show. They figure that out pretty fast. And the other, we go, whoa, all of a sudden they go, I'll start here.
As you were describing the children in the scholar phase, it just, off the top of my head, I would imagine that some children aren't going to be that kind of kid. Are some kids just built to be conveyor belt kids?
Good question. Let me ask you. Do you think God creates kids to just be workers and not do anything
great?
That's
a whole new philosophy.
I think it comes down to what you personally believe God created man to be. If you believe that God created man to do something great, then yeah. Now, realize that kids have different missions and they have different timetables. So some kids need specific types of education. Some kids may need a specific type of socialization for their mission. So that's where you and your husband prayerfully decide what each child needs. Yes?
This isn't really a question. It's I have a scholar-based son who is 16 who spends all day, every day, learning about small arts. It's not a subject I value. And it's a really hard question.
Right, yeah. Now realize, especially nowadays, we have a lot of boys that feel very drawn to war, and it really bothers moms, really. But you know what? They may have a mission in that, and we don't know where our world is going to be in the next few years. So don't pull your kids away from things that they may have a mission in. And realize that you may also need to inspire them in other ways. Maybe dad needs to do some other stuff to say, whoa, boy, do I love doing this. And all of a sudden he's like, just, you know, likes to say stuff, small arms, and do this other thing because he's been inspired to do that. But that's great. We had another question in the back. Yeah.
I guess my problem is me. I would like to model so many things, but I don't have time. I have children in every age and every phase, and I think I'm modeling driving the car. And changing diapers.
I'm going to talk about this a lot more in depth tomorrow when I talk about an educated woman, and a little bit later on when I talk about adult phases. Let me just tell you this. When my mom homeschooled, she started with a conveyor belt first because we were one of the first families in Arizona. Only the weirdos on the communes were doing the homeschooling, you know what I mean? There were no curriculums or fairs or anything like that. So she just brought home, you know, public school home. And then she got sick, thank goodness, because then we got to do whatever we wanted, and we had core phase and love of learning, and somehow she instinctively knew that if she studied, her kids would. And I'm sure there were times when she thought, oh, I probably should be doing math with them, but I feel like I should be studying this. And when I look back on my homeschool experience, I remember my mother learning about ancient Egypt and archaeology and learning about government, and all of us having this feeling like we would never catch up. She's always learning something so cool. And she talked about how excited she was, and it made all of us want to study. She didn't have to sit down with us anymore to say, make sure you're reading your math or doing your math, because we wanted to do it. We could do it on our own. We could do it really fast because we wanted to be like her. We found out later when I was in my 20s that my dad actually studied too. But he did it in the bathroom. I didn't know he read books. I didn't. And all of a sudden I found out my dad reads a lot. So doing it in front of your children is very important. I tell dads, come out of the bathroom. Be part of the family. It's super important that you do it in front of your kids. And yeah, you'll think, oh, I don't have enough time. Well, maybe it's book on tape while you're in the car. You can talk about it. Oh, my heavens, did you just hear that about Oliver Twist? That was so cool. Or, you know, you stop it and say, you guys, let's talk about that. That's when the modeling happens. You just have to be really creative. My mom always had things playing when she was working. I remember hearing, I have a little brother who can quote lines from Pride and Prejudice. He could do it at a very young age, like at 8. He would quote these lines from Pride and Prejudice, and it would make us all laugh because my mom would play, you know, books on tape over our speakers whenever she was cleaning something until he just got to the point where he's, I can't even do it. It's hilarious the way that he did it when he was so little. So yeah, you can just have to be creative about the way that you model.
I think I myself am scholar-based because I'm studying osteopathic now. Mm-hmm. It's a 6-year program. I've done my university and my daughter is 3 years old and my son is a year old. I feel like I should do the leadership program. With my studies, whenever I do study, when I have time to study, I have to go out of the house, like to spend the whole day or 2 days in the library. Can you still do?
Oh, sure. I mean, your children are in core phase, and they're still very young. And frankly, in order for you to get any study done at this point, you have to leave the house. I understand that. I understand. I have little kids. So, yeah, that's okay. I mean, the more that you're able to do things that they're interested in around them, the better, obviously. But really, the most important things for them to be learning right now is right, wrong, good, bad, true, false. You need to be working and playing with them, most of all. So whether they watch you studying, you know, this hard stuff, that's not going to be as important right this second as having them watch you enjoy working. Because they're going to be working their whole life. They need to know what it looks like as an adult to work. Is it drudgery for you, or do you enjoy it? Does mom play? Yeah, mom plays, and she has a great time, and so does dad. I mean, they watch you deal with relationship things and deal with order things and all those kinds of things when they're that age. So you're talking about why we clean our room, why we take care of the bathroom this way, so that they're learning those kinds of things. And then by the time they're getting to the point where they're transitioning to love of learning, that's when you start studying in front of them and studying things that you think would be important, like things you might be wanting to say, like maybe it's about Beethoven. They probably want to learn something about Beethoven. So you may not be studying specifically in your field because you're getting more of a professional thing right now, but you may want to broaden that when you're studying in front of them. I really appreciate the time I have had with you. I want to just leave one thing with you. Right now you may have a poor education, a mediocre education, or a great education. And more than likely, your children will have something similar. But in 5 years, what type of education are you going to have? Are you going to have a poor education, a mediocre education, or a great education? And I promise you, my prediction is, whatever you have, your kids will have the same thing. Thank you for your time.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.